Accession number 17993, Reel 2.
Squadron Leader Schweiger, Reel 2.
Yes, during this time, as I've just said, the amount of flying we did was reduced significantly, and a fairly boring time, but we did have some interesting episodes, particularly the visit of Vice President Richard Nixon, whom I met on two occasions. Rather amusingly, they selected, as the Americans call, veterans, and they lined us up on the US side of the airfield, and he came down and shook hands with us all and had a chat with us, and I suppose he had been briefed to ask a provocative question, was, do I come from Melbourne or Sydney? I was happy to tell him that I was British. And he should have realised that I was wearing a light blue uniform and the Australians were wearing blue ones, dark blue ones. However, we then went to our own side of the airfield and lined up in front of our aircraft. He was just scheduled to drive past, but he decided to stop. And he came up to me and he said, haven't we met before somewhere? And I said, yes, sir, about 20 minutes ago, across the other side of the airfield, and I'm still British. He seemed a very pleasant sort of chap. Also, I had the opportunity to go up to Freedom Village, where the returned prisoners were being processed, I suppose the word is, having been in prison in North Korea. And I went up there to welcome specifically the one RAF pilot who was a prisoner, Flight Lieutenant Olaf Berg, who was a South African in the Royal Air Force, and at the same time the Gloucester officers were also there. Colonel Kahn, who got a Victoria Cross, of course, Major Farrah Hockley, who was the adjutant of the Gloucesters, the Padre, whose name I regret, I can't remember.
And Sam Davis, I think.
I can't remember his name, but it was a most magnificent setting in a very quiet little valley, and beautiful huts had been built, and as these chaps came through the system, they were shown to their beds, and all their beds had their uniforms complete in the right size, any decorations they had been awarded that they didn't know about, for example, any promotions, and then we had a formal dinner out in the open air. Much jollity from these chaps and lots of stories, and then they showed the coronation film, which of course reduced many of these chaps to tears, I must admit, because it was very moving indeed. We had driven a long way over rather dusty roads and were somewhat dishevelled, and the the prisoners, of course, returning prisoners were immaculate in their new uniforms. And Air Marshal Barnett, who was the senior Commonwealth representative to United Nations in Korea, came and met us all, and I'm quite convinced he thought we were the prisoners and the other lot were the welcoming committee. And by coincidence, some little time later, I became his ADC, and I never had the nerve to ask him that one. Anyway, that was a very moving experience, and after some more months, I returned to the squadron, or was posted back to 208 Squadron in Egypt. On the way through Singapore, I was met by a senior personnel staff officer at Far East Air Force headquarters, who told me that I'd been selected, or rather was to be interviewed, for the post of ADC to the Commander Far East Air Force. And this was a bit of a shock to me, because I wanted to go back to my squadron and pick up where I'd left off. However, I still continued on my journey, and when I got to Egypt, rejoined the squadron, they said, oh, by the way, you've been posted as ADC to the AOC 205 group near Fayed in Egypt. So by that time I realised my number was up and I was an ADC. I was fortunate in being ADC to Air Marshal Harry Satterley, who was another very famous RAF wartime pilot. He had started as a Halton apprentice, started the war as a sergeant pilot, was commissioned, rose very rapidly, and was, I understand, very much involved with the planning of the 617 Squadron attack on the Ruhr Dams He was, I think, group captain plans, if I got it right, to Cochrane, who was the AOC at the time. He was a very nice chap to work for, and it was the most interesting job because it was not only a social job, though there was that part of it, but I was also his sort of private secretary. And lots of things were happening in Egypt. We had a huge parish, sort of all the way west to Brook, Malta, and all the way east out to Jordan, and south almost down to Aden. It's a huge parish, and lots of visiting. In fact, a jolly good time. He had his own very nice residence, and I lived on a houseboat on the Great Bitter Lake. I was the president of the mess committee of five officers who lived on this boat, which was rather splendid. The AOC lived quite close in his residence. We had a guard of the RAF regiment, and on one night I was on the houseboat by myself, and I was invaded by a lot of merchant seamen off a British ship anchored in the Great Bitter Lake. This is normal practice going through the canal. They'd quite often stop, a demanding drink. When I was about to hand over the keys, or rather get the Arab servant out of the chain locker forward to hand over the keys to the bar, when the RAF regiment patrol arrived with 10 guns and looking rather warlike, and the merchant seamen departed. The commander of this little detachment, the RAF regiment, was Flight Lieutenant Alastair Sutherland. And when later in my career I converted to the Canberra, by that time Alastair had been trained as a navigator, and he became my navigator. My strange coincidence. But I must say, on that occasion, I was very grateful to see him. We had a good time. I was fortunate to go to Baghdad, to Jerusalem with the AOC, and generally much enjoyed. I was then posted home and interviewed at the Air Ministry as practice, and told I was going on a flying instructor's course at Little Rissington in Gloucestershire, which was very near my home in Broadway. And I had discussed my future with Air Marshal Barnett, and I had decided, the result of that discussion, that I'd like to keep on squadron flying rather than instructing. So I said I'd like to keep on flying. They said, well, I'm afraid there are no vacancies in Fighter Command day fighter squadrons. And I'd happened to read in the newspaper that morning that they were expanding the night fighter force. And I said, what about night fighters? And they said, oh, yes, fine. So I then converted to the Meteor NF 11, 12, 13 and 14, the night fighter two-seater version of the Meteor, and was posted to Westmorling in Kent, to number 153 squadron.
How did you find the Meteor for night fighting work?
It seemed to be a very good aeroplane, particularly the later version, the 14, NF-14, which had the more advanced AI-21, the latest radar. It seemed to be fairly effective.
What dates approximately were you posted to 153?
I came back from Egypt in... Let me see, I'll have to refer to my logbook to jog my memory, if I may. Yes, I got to 153 Squadron at Westmorling in April 1955, and this was quite a large fighter command station. There were three night fighter squadrons, 25, 85 and 153, and auxiliary squadron 500 County of Kent. It's a very thriving airfield, and we carried out all the normal duties of a night fighter squadron. There we had a low-level interceptor day role as well, which is quite interesting because once again we were into the business of low flying, which is all very exciting. We had several detachments during big NATO or Fighter Command exercises where we had to deploy rapidly to another base, for example Manby up in Lincolnshire. And most enjoyable flying experience.
What was the anticipated role? Was it a Russian attack?
Yes, indeed so, yeah. We were actually called all-weather fighters. And I suppose to a certain extent that was true, in that we could, with the radar, we could intercept in cloud. But as I said, we had the secondary role of, by daylight, intercepting low flying Russian aircraft where there to be any.
I know that the type of interviews which I normally do on night fighters is back in the early days of 1941, when air interception was first coming in, and they had the most enormous difficulties intercepting anything at night in those days. Did you feel confident that you would be able to perform such a role by the mid-50s?
Yes, indeed. I think that two things. One is that the techniques had been improved, and what used to happen was the navigator sitting in the back of the aeroplane with his radar box would give certain commands, each of which meant something very precise, like go up 500 meant climb at 500 feet per minute, go left 30 meant go left at 30 degrees of bank, or go faster meant increase by 50 knots, for example. So you had effectively like a race commentary from the back seat, and you carried out to the best of your ability his commands. And the other thing was, of course, that the radar was enormously improved, and the AI-21, even though at this date, some while ago, was reliable and quite effective in picking up target.
How much did you know about the kind of aircraft which the Russians might deploy if there was a war?
Well, obviously we were briefed on aircraft recognition. Occasionally we would intercept an unknown target. This used to occur we used to deploy where we were on standby up to Wattisham in Norfolk, where we'd be on standby, you know, cockpit readiness to intercept any incoming aircraft. And occasionally, and it always, nearly always, was an airliner that hadn't filed a flight plan or a flight plan that hadn't got through, and so we'd find a Viscount or something tottering along at 20,000 feet would be the enemy.
What do you remember happening next?
After that, I was then posted to Headquarters Fighter Command in personnel, specifically to look after the night fighter air crew within Fighter Command. And there again, this was an exciting time, because Mr. Duncan Sands, who was Secretary of State for Defence, then produced his white paper, the infamous white paper, or infamous policy, which was that all future combat would be conducted by missiles, so that the time of the manned aircraft was limited. This then meant a reduction in the number of fighter command squadrons, both by day and by night, and the cancellation of the planned build-up, both in terms of the ground support, training, operations, and so on. And it was my job to try and sort this mess out, which involved a certain amount of burning of the midnight oil, as you can imagine. And suddenly the training machine had to be chopped. Fortunately, there were not too many redundancies per se. The training machine was stopped, but people came through. There were some, I regret, but mostly jobs were found for redundant air crew, albeit some of them were rather temporary in nature, but at least they were occupied and were not kicking their heels with nothing to do. Some were retrained, for example, as fighter controllers, but after about 6 or 7 months, it was decided to form a night fighter squadron in Singapore. So the Air Ministry required Fighter Command personnel, staff, i.e. me, to find enough air crew to man a squadron in Singapore. And I thought this would be easy. I'll just get these chaps back who are doing these sort of jobs, like organising Battle of Britain displays or mess secretary or something, and get them back and just form a squadron. But it wasn't like that at all, because none of the station commanders wanted to let these chaps go. But they'd formed a niche for themselves, they'd built a job for themselves, and they'd become invaluable. However, we managed to get enough to form a squadron out in the Far East.
So we're talking about the late 50s now.
Yes. And that takes us to about 56, I think. Then I decided I'd probably ought to try another role, and I volunteered for retraining to the Canberra. I went to Bassingbourne, where I met up with Alistair Sutherland, who I'd mentioned before as the RAF regiment officer, and I trained with Alistair and also somebody called John Robson, who was trained at Sandhurst in the RAF regiment, was also seconded as a general duties navigator, and he I think became Commandant General of the RAF regiment in his last job in the Air Force. We trained on the Canberra, and then I was posted to I'd volunteered to go to the Far East, to Singapore, to number 45 squadron, and I was told that's where I would be going, but unfortunately in some respects it was cancelled at the last minute because something was going to happen to me which they couldn't tell me about because it was confidential, but it wouldn't be possible for me to go to Singapore. Well, I knew exactly what that meant. It meant I was going to be promoted, so I was sent to number 59 squadron in Germany, Geilenkirchen, just across the border, the Dutch border. And our role was quite an interesting one. We had a nuclear role, a low-level attack using LAB system, low-altitude bombing system, where effectively you attack the target flying at low level, high speed, pulled up, halfway up the climb, you let the bomb go, which then was propelled forward, you then continued the climb and to the top of the loop, and then you rolled off to level flight and then darted for the ground and got out of it quick. We also had a role with 1,000-pound bombs, conventional bombs, to be carried either in the bomb bay or on the wings. And we could also fit a gun pack of four 30mm cannon, so we could then have an air-to-ground role, which we practiced all the three of these things, either in Germany. Low flying by day and by night. By night was quite interesting. And also we used to deploy out to the Middle East to the range at Tahuna, which is near Tripoli.
What was the Canberra like to fly?
Generally speaking, very good. The BI-8, the low-level interdictor version, which I've just described, was an interesting aeroplane. Its one drawback was that the cockpit hood was fixed, and so in high temperatures, for example in the Middle East when we went out there, it was pretty painfully hot inside. But once you got in the air with the air conditioning system working, it was quite tolerable.
How did you like it after the meteor?
I was still a fighter jockey at heart, though I did enjoy the low flying again, and we also had a photographic role as well. I'd forgotten that, so we had four roles to practice, and it could be quite exciting. Then I was posted back to the UK when I was promoted to squadron leader.
What date are we reaching now?
When about 57. Freedom.
That, just to give an idea.
Yeah, yeah, about 57 time. Then I went to I was posted to number 9 squadron at Coningsby as on Canberra BI-6s as a flight commander. My job was to control the squadron's airmen and the squadron's aircraft and oversee the servicing, but at the same time of course taking a full part in the flying program. However, after a year, it was decided to re-equip number 9 squadron, which is my squadron at Coningsby, with the Vulcan, and I was told I was posted to the Air Ministry in operational requirements as project officer for the TSR-2. That posting took place in July 1961. The TSR-2, of course, was the multi-role, high-performance, quite extraordinary aeroplane being developed by British Aerospace, as it now is known as, and engined by Bristol Siddeley, now part of Rolls-Royce. And my job was to oversee the development of the aircraft to ensure that the specification led to an operationally satisfactory aircraft. This meant regular visits to the aircraft industry. Of course, there were many firms concerned in the aircraft, not only the airframe and engine manufacturers, but all the equipment manufacturers as well. So a great deal of my time was spent either at Wharton or Lithers Medans or Bristol, Smith's Industries at Gloucester, for example, discussing turning technology into practicalities for a pilot. The reason it seems that I've been selected for this job was my experience in all the various roles of which the TSR-2 was capable. I took over from an interesting chap, a squadron leader, Podge Howard, who was the captain of the Vulcan that was doing the Australia-UK airspeed record and crashed, landed short at London Airport Heathrow, if you remember, some years ago. A very interesting time indeed. The TSR-2 was subject to a lot of political attack. People felt it was a waste of money. It was designed for a role that was no longer appropriate. And quite a lot of my time was spent in briefing ministers, either face-to-face or on paper, answering parliamentary questions, or rather giving the answers to the minister to answer parliamentary questions, giving presentations to visiting officers from other services, other nations' services, with the object of trying to persuade them to buy the aircraft. Trip to America. Generally, a very varied time. However, somewhere along the line, Hawker Aircraft at Kingston had produced a design called the P-1127 Orchestral, and I was asked to take this role on as well as project officer for the P-1127. It became obvious that this was a most promising project, and it was clearly impossible for me to do both the TSR-2 and the P-1127, so I was then moved solely for the 1127, which meant that I spent my time discussing things with people like Sir Sidney Cam, who was designer, John Fossard, designer P-1127, and Bill Bedford, chief test pilot. Out of all this program came the Harrier, and a tripartite squadron of the UK, US and Germany was formed to do trials with aircraft, nine aircraft based in the UK. I went again to Washington, to the Pentagon, to try and persuade the Americans that it was a good aircraft and that perhaps they might consider buying it, which eventually the US Marine Corps did in their version. Again, much visiting the aircraft industry, extremely interesting time. And then I acquired another hat, which was a member of a NATO committee, because NATO had got the idea that they ought to have a joint aircraft of this type, and there was a competition set up, a NATO basic military requirement, and I was the UK delegation, just me, of the working committee, which meant I spent some of my time in Paris, where NATO then was. And after about 6 or 7 months of discussions, the winner of the competition against the French Mirage 3V, aircraft from America, Canada, and so on, was the winner, as far as the military were concerned. But unfortunately, we were the only committee of the four that actually reached a conclusion. The other three committees were still arguing when it was decided that enough was enough and that discussion should cease. So the actual result was a draw, since no aircraft was actually selected. However, the 1127 Harrier went ahead. Hawkers then produced a design called the P-1154, which was a supersonic version of the Harrier. This involved afterburning, effectively, fuel in the nozzles. If you remember, the Pegasus engine has four swiveling nozzles, I should say, and fuel was burnt to give it more thrust, higher gross takeoff weight, and supersonic speed as an interceptor. The air staff decided that they needed this aircraft, and so an operational requirement was then written around the Hawker design. Again, I acquired this responsibility. At the same time, Armstrong Whitworth had produced a vertical and short takeoff transport aircraft called the AW681. So then the three projects on which the future of the RAF seemed to depend at that time was the TSR-2, the P-1154, and the AW681. A great deal of political argument went on over these projects, and in October of 64, when the Labour government seemed certain to win the election under Harold Wilson, the air staff, knowing the political feeling of the Labour Party, had to rethink its policy. It was decided at senior level not to press for the PLM-54, not to press for the AW681, but to keep the TSR-2 at all costs. This fight, if I might say so, was rather given up before the battle was even joined. No attempt was made to justify the two projects to be dropped, despite the fact that I had been writing briefs for example, Mr. Peter Thornycroft, other ministers, justifying the requirements and of course, believing that they were required, and then suddenly the rug was pulled out from underneath me, which I rather resented, I must admit, at the time. Anyway, I completed my 3.5 years at the Ministry of Defence, reverting back to the P-1127, which was still going ahead, I think mostly as a Hawker's private venture, and was then rather unusually posted to the RAF Staff College as a student. It would not be normal to be a student before taking on an important staff job at the MOD, as it had come by then, but I did it the other way round. I went to the Staff College. Of course, the Air Force, like all the military services, were in a certain amount of turmoil, and having spent 3.5 years actually working in the MOD and seeing how things were really done, I found Staff College a little academic, nonetheless an extremely interesting and quite demanding course. There's some very splendid exercises. One of the ones I remember mostly was each student was briefed to be a colonel on Goering's staff, and you have to brief and write a paper